just kind of our gathering activity. I'm Martha Meyer, and we'll say a little bit more about ourselves in a minute. But those of you who did the quiz, I just want to ask you if you learned anything.
That I didn't know about.
Okay, tell us one thing that you learned. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this quiz. You can go ahead and answer. But all the first page are true. So was there anything you learned? Well, what was one of the things you learned that you didn't know?
Well, I didn't think that Francis Drake thing.
No, I'm just a kid.
Oh, that Francis Drake was out here?
Yeah. Was he actually here or simply claimed to be?
Sure, there's a hotel named after him in San Francisco because he was here. The Francis Drake Hotel, one of the best hotels in it used to be.
Francis anyway. Drake hotels in other cities too.
That he didn't go to, yeah. Well, he went there.
Okay. Well, that was news.
Anything else that was news?
I learned that Roman Catholic bishops did urge the priest to marry for mixed race couples.
Yeah, that's kind of fun, wasn't it?
Even if they had to go to jail.
Something else?
Flicking off the phone.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Anything else that surprised you that you learned from this? You probably didn't all have a chance to go through it, but you can take it home and study it tonight. So your problem is no more prop quizzes in this class.
Well, this is your first and last test.
I thought it was kind of, we're going to be talking a little more later on about religion in the Northwest. And again, some of the explanations, you can maybe read those later, but it's interesting that Roman Catholics are the largest denomination out here, but they represent only 11% of the population. Lutherans are about 2% out here. How many are they in Minnesota or Iowa? You know? More than that.
Question, do we know what percentage Mormons are in the Northwest?
I do, and I'll show that. We have that slide tomorrow, but I can...
Is that 11% of the total population, or 11%
this is 11,
of the church?
This is 11% of the total population, the Catholics claim, or...
Because I heard some figure about fewer than 10% of people under a certain age were churched in the Pacific Northwest.
There could be. I don't know that statistic.
I don't know that statistic, but that could very well be.
Okay. Yeah.
Our source book says that 3% of the population are Mormon.
More Mormons than Lutherans.
Mormons than Lutherans, right. Sure. Growing. I think faster than we are, too. Mm-hmm.
And of course, in certain parts of the, if you go east of the Cascades, of course, you're probably going to lose a little bit more. Yeah.
Now, when you're looking at the Northwest, you're looking primarily at the Northwest American.
We're going to talk about that, you know, how you define it. Some of the things that we're talking about are mostly true of Washington and Oregon, although you could think about, I put a map up here, I don't know if you can see it very well, but this is a map that's titled the Pacific Northwest, and it goes from southeast Alaska all the way down to San Francisco Bay. And part of what it shows here is watersheds. Now, for example, the Columbia River watershed, which is part of the Northwest, goes way up into the interior, into the Rockies, and actually into Idaho and Montana. So it kind of depends upon how you think of the Northwest. And some of the material that we have is mostly focused on Washington and Oregon. And some of the material that we have goes across the border into Canada and applies to more states than that. So that's a good question. So, yeah, well, you always have to kind of figure out what you're actually talking about there.
But do you want to get the official welcome and
overview? Okay. I want to welcome you to this. We're going to be doing a series of these called Practicing Our Faith in Salmon Nation. And my name is John Rosenberg, and I'm a pastor in Olympia, Washington.
And I'm Martha Meyer, a pastor in Vancouver, Washington.
And the way this got started, actually, was with a book by Patricia Killen called Religion and Public Life in the Pacific Northwest, The Nun Zone, N-O-N-E. And we hope that before the end of the week, anybody familiar with that book or seen it? We're hoping this will be in the bookstore. It's not there yet, but it has to do with some sort of a dispute between Holden and the Wholesaler, so we hope it gets there. But the writer of this book, the editor of this book, one of the editors is Patricia Killam, who's the provost at Pacific Lutheran University, and she's a professor of religion there. And about 5 years ago, she convened a group of clergy. There were about 8 of us, along with Sam Torben, who's also a professor of religion at PLU, to talk about some of the themes in this book and to see if there might be some application or some kind of a connection between the kinds of things she was talking about religion and public life in the Pacific Northwest and the ministry that we carry on here as ELCA pastors. And I think, you know, part of our motivation was that we just wanted to be better pastors, and we wanted to help our people to find some ways to practice our faith in a place where they have been and probably always will be a minority. This is one of the statements that she makes early in the book. She says, the defining feature of religion in the Pacific Northwest is that most of the population is unchurched. Fewer people in Oregon, Washington, and Alaska affiliate with a religious institution than in any other region of the United States. Although I noticed that, as an aside, I think that New Hampshire or Vermont is moving in on our territory. So. But she goes on to say, more people claim none when asked their religious identification. And unlike any other region, the single largest segment of the Pacific Northwest population is composed of those who identify with a religious tradition. So this is an important distinction. Who identify with a religious tradition but have no affiliation with a religious community. So in other words, those are folks who, if you ask them, they'd say, well, you know, I'm a Lutheran, or my grandparents were Lutheran, or I was baptized as a Lutheran. And if you followed up and said, well, is there a congregation that you connect with, that they would say no. So they identify, but they don't affiliate. And that's a, I think that, again, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about is going on, and it's not completely unique to this part of the country, but probably the numbers are a little bit unique. And so how do you practice your faith in a place like that? And that we had a couple questions that were sort of guiding.
Could I interrupt with a demographic question?
Yeah.
Well, what percent of the population along that in the area we're talking about, the Salmon Nation, is folks who would be, you know, like from the old school Lutheran areas, Germany, Norway, Sweden, would have an ethnic identification like that, you know?
Yeah, I don't know that answer to that.
Okay.
But it's a good question.
Okay.
Yeah. So we had a couple of questions that we used, but it was mainly about, you know, how do people make sense of life here in a place where they have a spiritual sense, but often don't have a community that they connect with. A couple of you have asked about the name Salmon Nation, and that actually came out of a group that we spent some time with in Portland, Oregon, Eco Trust. And it's a way to think about this as a bioregion. And there have been other names that people have talked about. One of them, some of you may remember a novel that came out about 30 years ago by a guy named Ernest Kallenbach called Ecotopia, which was this sort of sliver of country along the coast that went down to Northern California that somehow ended up not part of the United States anymore, and they had their own country and all of that stuff. And so that's been one way to think about it. Another way to think about it has been to call it Cascadia, and the business community has particularly adopted that idea. And Cascadia, when people talk about it, usually includes not only the U.S., but also includes British Columbia. And so one of the books that we have in the bookstore is called Cascadia, the Elusive Utopia. And that has essays in it about religion and spirit from both American scholars, but also from U.S. scholars, but also from scholars from Canada, and talking about some. So some of the stuff that we're talking about is even more the case in British Columbia than it is in the U.S.
Yes, many of the people in British Columbia feel quite disconnected from everything. They don't feel connected to the United States, and they don't feel connected to Eastern Canada.
Yeah, they're sort of all by themselves over there, yeah.
I saw an article in the newspaper up in Vancouver that the caption was, environmentalism is our new religion.
Right. Oh, we'll talk about that.
We're gonna talk about that. That's
tomorrow.
That's a very good point.
Well, you might wanna talk about why salmon though, when people aren't from the region.
So we'll talk a little bit more about salmon, the actual biology of salmon tomorrow, but salmon is a pretty important, has been a pretty important part of the culture out here. They provided this huge source of protein for the people who lived here originally, the indigenous peoples, who basically based their whole life on the cycle of the salmon, who basically, if you don't know the story, are born in fresh water and then swim out to the ocean at some point in their lives and become very big, depending on how long they stay there. And then they come back. The interesting thing about salmon is that they come back to the place where they were born, and they lay their eggs. And Pacific salmon, unlike some other forms of anadromous fish, die. And then their decaying bodies basically provide food for the next generation of salmon who do the cycle all over again. And it's kind of this, they're important as a source of protein and all of that and life, but they're also a very important symbol. And you know, if you think about that cycle of the salmon, there's some powerful spiritual imagery there as well, that death out of life. You know, it almost makes a perfect, in some ways, a perfect kind of a natural analogy to the theology of the cross. And we can talk some more about that. But so Salmon Nation is places where the salmon go. It's kind of a way to think about the bioregion. And, you know, they go way into the interior. So they go through the Cascades aren't necessarily the thing that separates the salmon, because they go into the interior of Canada as well as the U.S., into Idaho back in the old days into Montana.
So I've got this picture of us, John. Do you want to talk about our...
This is a group of us. The bottle that I'm holding in this picture is a bottle of Salmon Nation beer, one of the craft brewers in Portland put out a Salmon Nation beer. And this was the group of pastors that were part of this. And I don't think Sam Torvin or Patricia Killen are in this picture. But what we did was we talked with people. We talked with journalists. We talked with writers. We talked with a couple historians and sociologists and a couple of theological thinkers from this area. And we spent a lot of time listening, just asking questions and learning whatever we could about the place where we are. And then we took that and tried to reflect on it and tried to put that together with some of our Lutheran theology and say, okay, what works here and what doesn't work here? And this was we got together about three or four times a year. We got a grant from the Louisville Institute that sort of helped us to do that and paid for things like transportation and child care.
And beer.
And beer.
I think I paid for that, actually.
Yeah.
And what we did towards the end of this project is, we had 3 years and we were done with our official project, but we had some money left over, and so we spent some time putting together an adult curriculum that can be used in churches, and we've also been spending some time disseminating Salmon Nation, as we call it, which is why we're kind of here today, sharing what we've learned with others, just as a way of sharing the wealth, I guess.
Everything that we're doing here and all the resources and all the handouts that we've got are available to you. There's a website listed at the bottom of the handout that I gave you, www.salmonluther-house.org. And you can basically download the whole curriculum if you want to, along with the resources. So if there's something that, you know, we don't have enough handouts for, something that you want, or you want to do this in your church or whatever, it's there and available for you to use and print out. And so we're kind of test driving it here. We're trying it out on you, but it's there for you to use. And we'd like people to use it and see how it works and change what doesn't and all that. So.
Right. And if you're not from the Northwest, you can take our process and make it fit your content.
Part of the thing with this, there's a series of 9 of these books called Religion and Public Life in the U.S., and they've divided up, it's called the Religion by Region series. So, for example, we did one of these workshops over in Eastern Washington, which in some ways identifies with Eastern Washington and Idaho, in some ways have more in common with the Mountain West, with Wyoming and Montana and those states, with their realities, as much as they do with the people on the coast. And one of these books is called Religion and Public Life in the Mountain West, Sacred Landscapes and Tension, and that talks about some of the religious realities there. There's one for the Midwest, for those of you from Minnesota, called Religion and Public Life in the Midwest, Heartland is Real America by Philip Barlow. I don't know if anybody knows him, but you know him?
No.
Okay.
Well, when we gathered in our group, again, we tried to frame what we did in worship, and so during these sessions, we will frame what we do in worship, and so we have just a very brief worship time tonight as we get started. Let's just begin with a prayer. So, gracious God, we give you thanks for the abundance of this place, the abundance of people, the abundance of resources, the abundance of salmon and everything that you have made. Help us to continue to rejoice in all that you have done, to rejoice in your love. And we ask a special blessing with us tonight as we reflect on what it means to be your people in this place. We pray this in your name. Amen. And I'd like to read a part of a psalm. It's Psalm 104. How manifold are your works, O Lord! In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Yonder is the sea, great and wide, with its swarms too many to number, living things both small and great. There go the ships to and fro, and Leviathan, which you have made for the sport of it. All of them look to you to give them their food in due season. You give it to them, they gather it, you open your hand, and they are filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are terrified. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. You send forth your spirit, and they are created, and so you renew the face of the earth. And I'd like to continue with a little blessing litany from the Chinook people who are a part of the Northwest region traditionally, or at least this is attributed to them. There are little sentences we will read, and then we will all respond with teach us and show us the way, and I'll kind of put my hand out so you know it's your turn to say teach us and show us the way, and there'll be some people helping me with this reading. So we call upon the earth, our planet home, with its beautiful depths and soaring heights, its vitality and abundance of life, and together we ask that it
teach us and show us the way.
We call upon the mountains, the Cascades and the Olympics, the high green valleys and the meadows filled with wild flowers, the snows that never melt, the summits of intense silence, and we ask that they
teach us and show us the way.
We call upon the waters that rim the earth, horizon to horizon, that flow in our rivers and streams, that fall upon our gardens and fields, and we ask that they
teach us and show us the way.
We call upon the land which grows our food, the nurturing soil, the fertile fields, the abundant gardens and orchards, and we ask that they
teach us and show us the way.
We call upon the forest, the great trees reaching strongly to the sky with earth in their roots and the heavens in their branches, the fir and the pine and the cedar, and we ask them to
teach us and show us the way.
We call upon the creatures of the fields and the forests and the seas, our brothers and sisters, the wolves and deer, the eagle and doves, the great whales of the dolphin, the beautiful orca and salmon who share our Northwest home, and we ask them to
teach us and show us the way.
We call upon all those who have lived on the earth, our ancestors and our friends, who dreamed the best for the future generations, and upon those whose lives are lives, upon those whose lives, our lives are built, and thanksgiving we call upon them to
teach us and show us the way.
And lastly, we call upon all that we hold most sacred, the presence and power of the great spirit of love and truth which flows through all the universe to be with us, to
teach us and show us the way.
Amen. Well, we've got a little activity here for you. I'm really bad at these PowerPoints. Okay, this is one of the first we call them conversation partners. These eight pastors would get together and we'd invite someone in to talk to us. And one of the first people we invited in with was Timothy Agin. You've got his book there.
Yeah, I don't know how many of you have. He's written a couple. In fact, he won the National Book Award for a book he wrote called The Worst Hard Time about the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma. But this is a book that he wrote in the late 80s called The Good Rain Across Time and Terrain in the Pacific Northwest. And as Martha said, he I don't think he works for the New York Times.
I don't think that's any more of a buzz.
He's got a blog in there on the opinion page that he writes about. His blog is about Western type issues, so he's worth taking a look at if you're looking for a good read.
Lives in Seattle.
Lives in Seattle, yeah, grew up in Spokane, I think, and went to Gonzaga, so.
And he was very interesting. I think when you invited him to talk to eight Lutheran pastors, he wasn't quite sure what he was getting into. but he warmed up to us. Well, anyhow, as we met with these conversation partners, we had enough money that we taped everybody's conversation, and then we got transcriptions of our conversations that went on for pages. But it was kind of fun later on as we went through some of it, kind of to reflect on what we've heard, and also then as we were putting together some material to pull out some of the quotes that we really liked. And so I've got a quote here from Tim Agin that I'm going to read to you. You can also read it if you'd like, because I've got it on the PowerPoint, and then we've got a little activity that goes with this. But this is one of the things that he said to us. He says, people emigrating to the Northwest have always left their paths behind. Someone once told me that the Oregon Trail was a perfect metaphor for the Northwest, because the further west you went, the more family heirlooms you threw off the wagon because you had to lighten the load. Finally, when you arrive in the Dalles, you say, do I really want to get rid of the organ? Or the piano, or something really heavy that you've carried this fall, and you say, what the hell? And throw it off. You are left with nothing as you arrive in the Northwest. Well, then Timothy said, I think this is a good metaphor for how we are a region of newcomers. We are a region of people from somewhere else. There's always been that sense of escape. You come here and you're going to try something completely different. You are going to shed your past. And we thought there was some truth to what he had to say here. We wanted to find out if this is true for you. It's going to be a little bit more difficult because some of you aren't from the West. But what we want to imagine is that maybe you've decided to travel to the West. What we want you to do is that we're going to, we want you in a group of two or three, and don't do that quite yet, but just in a minute. And we're not going to have a long time for this, but we want you to briefly in your group, you can share your name, a little bit of background about you and how your family ended up in the Northwest. If you're not here permanently, you know how you ended up at Holden or in this part of the country. And then if you live in the West, what are some of those heirlooms that your family left behind whenever they came here? It could be physical objects, or it could be cultural objects, it could be church connections or institutional connections or other affiliations. What's that quote like? The Rockies are paved with letters of transfers from Christians who have moved west, that they've left their transfers far behind because they never made it to their churches, but they never made it to the church in the West. And if you're not live here now, what would you want to leave behind if you moved out west? So that could be your question. And then again, discuss how leaving heirlooms in the broadest sense of the word behind might influence the religious life out here in the Northwest if you've got time. So do you think you can divide yourself up into groups or two or three? I can three or four actually, three or four would work too. So let's come back together to the quotes on the large group.
If you can pull yourself away, we'll find out what's littering the trail.
Do you want to find what's littering it, or what they
think? Oh, go ahead.
I'm not actually going to ask you, you shared what's littering the trail, but just again, a couple, how do you think people leaving things behind might influence religious landscape of the Northwest? What did your groups come up with?
I had a great answer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Do you remember what you said?
Well, it can be very much a social organization, either with family or friends, and they decide to leave all that. It may not be as easy to find that community or relationship. And you went because your parents expected you to, or everybody in town talked if you didn't, and so you move out.
So suddenly there's no family members, and there's no kind of social community to draw you because you don't know anybody.
No.
So that, you know, that thing that might, you know, lure you into a community is no longer there. Or maybe even reinforce your participation in the community. Your mom's not there to see if you went to church or not. You know? That was true for me.
We decided over here that even people from very, you know, Luther communities in rural Minnesota come to the city, and they dropped a few things along the way, too.
Okay. Other things that people came up with. Yeah.
I mean, I hadn't really thought about this until you already told us to shut up.
Oh.
I went ahead and said it anyway. One of the things that we left behind is kind of the cultural styles, like from the Midwest to come to the Northwest. The Midwest has a much more direct style of communication, and I think there's something about the way that Midwestern people are more direct people. Have a more difficult time fitting into such a non-direct religious environment. It's like you sometimes are talking to people who may have gone someplace else while you were talking to them.
Direct.
Well, there's a tendency, my sense is that there's a tendency to back off and let you kind of take a pill or something. So, you know, because it's just a little bit too much. So is it kind of a live and let live, like I'm not going to, don't impose your religious beliefs on me and then
it's
I won't do
it. Religious belief, it's a cultural style of communication,
okay.
Cultural way of being. And after a while, you tend to adapt, or you find different people who are also like Dick on a visa from the East.
That you can communicate with. Okay. What else?
Well, you know, I think originally, John, Lutherans in the Pacific Northwest were there because there was some cultural thing that happened.
Right.
Like my dad's family came here, and there were a whole bunch of German Russians that were in the Palouse Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Now my grandfather's farm failed because it was too dry, but then they moved to Oregon and they immediately associated with German Russians. Matter of fact, my dad was sent 40 miles from home so he could go to a church where he could get confirmed in German.
Okay.
Yeah, and so there were the Finns, you know, in the Balfour district. And so I think to a large the Lutheran Church in the Northwest, you know, came about to, because there were these little enclaves of Lutherans from Europe. And now I belong to a church in Portland now that its claim to fame, it was started in about 1860, its claim to fame is that it was the first Lutheran church in Portland and services were in English.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and my dad actually preached in German and had German services up until, well, I can remember them maybe up into the 40s.
Okay.
So initially it was a cultural
thing. Yeah, it was a cultural thing, I think, initially for Lutherans in the Northwest because they did come and not everybody came over the Oregon Trail.
Right.
Yeah, there were people who came originally to this part of the world.
interesting, when I did this exercise in my church, and what I found, I'm in Vancouver, Washington, actually, people that come from the West, they all came from California, escaping, a lot of them, just the, all the people there.
Whatever it is that you want to escape.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Well, you know, this again is just kind of one of those thought questions to keep you thinking, and we'll talk more about, you know, how we think things might be different out here as we go through, but a lot of our project was just kind of raising the questions and pondering them, so you know, hopefully we can continue some of this conversation. There's not a lot about, you know, Lutheran history in the, there must be a few books, but it's hard to find much about Lutheran history in the
Northwest.
I think we asked Sam about that, there's not too much out here.
And stuff like that.
So you need to write it.
Well.
So you're going to go on, you're going to talk a little bit about...
I've got more of these handouts.
A little bit more, go back to the discussion.
So if anybody wants one here, but I want to refer to the back of your quiz. So if anybody can get one, I still got a few of the book. Or you can have this one. But this was, on the back of this thing, there's some bullet points on characteristics of the Northwest. And these, some of these, you know, you can kind of test these out and see if they still work. This is from my teacher was a guy named Gordon Dodds, but this is what he had to say. And he wrote about the Northwest, but he was thinking particularly of Oregon when he wrote this. One of them is the proximity to nature, and you've heard that already in terms of the opening devotion. The Chinook Psalter is full of that natural imagery and how important that is to folks here. And again, this is not to say that nature isn't important in other parts of the world, but the proximity to nature and the fact that a lot of the early economics here, at least for white folks, came from extractive industries that were based on resources. Mining, you know, we're here on the site of a mine, timber, fishing, and that kind of thing. Cheap hydropower has been a real part of the legacy of the Northwest. I think we still get about 40 to 50% of our power from hydro here, unlike other parts of the country. So that was one. A second one was Northwesterners have historically not been real community-minded. So this is a place where one of the paradoxes is that everybody longs for community. But part of the thing with community is that you have to have some kind of sense of shared past. You know, and when you basically get rid of your heirlooms along the trail and your shared story, and because you want a new start, you don't no longer have that past to draw on. And that's one of the results of that is a longing for community and yet a lack of it. And he gives some examples there of how that comes through tax limitation measures, low support for the arts and education, reluctance of people to commit time and dollars to charitable causes in comparison to other regions. Interestingly enough, since he talked about that, the Northwest has become one of the leading places for philanthropy, due in large part to Bill and Melinda Gates and some of the. But that particular thing has changed a little bit. Third one was, you know, we've talked about this, the land of the second chance, people coming out on the Oregon Trail, oftentimes were people who were leaving not much behind. They needed a break. I remember when I was a pastor in Vancouver doing funeral services, and in some ways you could use the life story, you know, I felt like I was burying the same person over and over again. But these were people who had come out in the 30s because of difficulties with the Depression or lost a farm or something in the Dakotas or Minnesota, you know, got work. I remember I was talking about a guy today who'd gotten work on the Grand Coulee Dam, you know, this huge public works project that was part of the New Deal. And that happened over and over again. It's been relatively homogeneous. Marco straightened me out on this one, but most of the residents have been of Northern European descent. That, of course, leaves out the people who were already here. And others have been uncomfortable here. So there's a real interesting
history here of how different ethnic groups have gotten along. That's changing rapidly. My wife was a principal of a high school in Vancouver, Washington, where people came from 50 different countries and spoke over 30 different languages in the homes of the students there. But you know, that's a relatively new sort of thing here. It's been a fairly homogeneous population. And it's always been a colony. It's been an economic colony. Hudson's Bay Company, of course, was very prominent out here early on. Railroads, timber. We still export raw logs here. I see them in the Port of Olympia going off to, and then we buy them back as finished products at much more money. Politically, the seniority system has greatly benefited our region. Bernard DeVoto said that Northwesterners' attitude toward the federal government is being sort of like an adolescent, leave us alone and give us more money. That actually was said about the whole West. So, and then cultural, except for the Native Americans and a few writers, our region has not been artistically innovative or distinctive. Again, that may be changing with some of the original writers. And then religiously, we always seem to get our theological experts from outside the region. With few exceptions, there haven't been many new religions, although we've had some strange ones. I'm thinking of the Rajneesh, and some other ones. We are sort of a, if you've gone from here to a church-wide assembly as a voting member, you know that basically the people in the Midwest kind of look at us as sort of an oddity here. they don't know about us, and they don't really care about us that much. So, and then the last one is despite a progressive reputation, which Northwesterners have, there's sort of a politically conservative libertarian tone to our politics. Gordon Dodds is really big on this. He talked about Oregonians, particularly, as being cheap progressives. They vote for any progressive legislation as long as it didn't cost any money. So, decriminalization of marijuana doesn't cost anybody any money. The bottle bill. On a more serious note, we have two states here have passed assisted suicide, physician assisted death. So those are things that, again, they're in some people's minds. I don't know if they're progressive or not, but they don't cost anybody anything, relatively speaking. So those are some things that characterize the region, and you may know some more. We're kind of going doing this in a little down and dirty fashion. But as you think about that, I suppose the question for us then is, you know, what kinds of spiritual yearnings might you expect from people in the Northwest? You know, what sorts of what would they be looking for spiritually?
Aren't a lot of people who come out here more independently minded, who don't want to be confined physically or mentally?
So I think that there's some truth to that. So in other words, part of the yearning for them might be, if you were going to couch it that way, to think about people looking for freedom.
Freedom, okay.
Yeah, independence, the ability
independence. I'm from Montana, especially.
Okay, all right.
I think that's true.
Somebody's from Montana here. Does that resonate with your experience?
I think so, yeah.
Your husband is nodding, so. I don't know if he's thinking about you
don't
or not.
Don't touch my land.
You've got
to check in.
All right. Yeah,
right. Relative to the first statement, John, about one-fifth of the nation's total land base, we also probably have the largest percentage of land owned by state and federal governments.
Yeah, it's an incredible amount.
It's an incredible amount. So, you know, if you look at that versus the population.
Well, and we're right on some of it.
Yeah.
So what would there be a yearning in that?
But I think the point, though, is if you subtract that out, because of a lot of it's not buildable or usable land for most purposes, then I don't think the ratio is so dramatically different. But, you know, one of the points I wanted to make is this is still, relatively speaking, pioneer country. I lived in Boston, and there, you know, old is 300 years. Well, here, old is 100 years. And of course it makes a difference. But I strongly disagree with a lot of these things.
I do too.
Quoted from Dot.
All right.
I challenge some of these things.
I'll give you an example on community, the second point. I was a founding member of Winslow Co-Housing, which was the first co-housing community in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a large number of co-housing communities in the West, in Washington State,
mm-hmm.
Following our example. And that's a very strong movement and
okay.
Very successful.
We don't know what that is.
Co-housing, it was started in Denmark as kind of a response to the communes of the 1960s, which of course we have here too, but with the idea of a better balance between community and privacy. So everybody has their own house, but there's also a common house, and at the one that I helped to build, we did shared dinners 5 nights a week. We had 80 people in 30 households, all ages, and just did a lot of different things together as a community. We had about 6 acres of land, and it's, like I said, it's a strong and growing.
So you're saying that you think there is a, at least there's a desire on the part of people for some community.
Well, the intentional community is built because your natural, you know, ancestral community has been severed by migrating such a long way. But
okay.
Yes, the desire and the reality is here. And, you know, I see a lot of community. I see in Seattle cul-de-sacs where people have dinner together in that neighborhood, even by the end house when it becomes vacant and set up.
Okay.
You know, a similar kind of thing. And so I just think, you know, that's not a correct or current statement.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful maybe for both of us to know, you know, you said this was a study from important themes that emerged from a study of the region's history. So these themes have come from maybe a couple hundred years of history. And when did he end the study? You know, when was it done?
Well, I should say it is somewhat dated.
He died 2 years ago, so.
But I mean, the last, it might have been written from about 20 years ago, you know, maybe
right.
1990.
And I'm wondering if it's too broad a generalization. We live in Bellingham, which is a relatively small community, and I think incredibly spirited as a community.
Okay.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
all
with
kinds of community agriculture
and
the farmer's market all kinds of community activity.
Yeah.
Maybe if you're talking about an urban location, apartments in downtown Seattle, where no one talks to each other,
but
that's true in all cities.
No, San Francisco is very community minded.
Well,
if
that's
you measure
true,
something like the number of the farmer's market,
the Pike Street Market was
yeah,
one
that's
of the
true.
First
yeah. Yeah.
farmers' markets in the entire country.
Yeah. So
anyway,
yeah.
Northwesterners defending the
seems
community
like
minded.
Yeah.
The past have not been, but now it's different. You know, you've got the tents, have not been.
Right, yeah.
But
also, you say culturally,
I disagree.
I didn't experience, I had experienced this. I was living in Seattle in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and there was a rep company there,
yeah.
theater rep company.
Yeah.
There was the beginnings of several independent theater companies, professional level,
yeah.
And they have, as I understand it, matured now so that they're taken very seriously. And there were art galleries galore. The visual artists are very evident here, much more so than in Minneapolis, Minnesota, or St. Paul. I mean, walking around the Twin Cities, do you run across an art gallery
sure.
every four
well,
blocks or something like that?
That's what neighborhood
are you in?
Well, what neighborhood in Minneapolis has that many?
So we need to bring this to closure.
Yeah. Warehouse District, the art district in Northeast, maybe.
Uptown?
No.
Well, we're gonna, that kind of getting to the you can take these for whatever they're worth to you. I think that the question becomes, what are the, and the thing I guess we want to use to segue into the stuff we want to talk about tomorrow is, what sorts of spiritual yearnings might people who live in this part of the world have? And we don't necessarily want to answer that now, but we would like you to think about it. If you're a person in the Northwest, what's your, you know, what kind of questions are you asking, and what are you looking for?
And we don't, you know, are they different than you might be asking elsewhere? Maybe so, maybe not.
No.
So, do you want to close with a prayer?
Sure, I can do that. And then if people want to stick around and talk, we can do that.
And this
is, we can argue about those traits if you want.
Yeah. So these slides, this book, this is our website, which is also on the handouts. But the first book is, as Donna said, isn't in the bookstore yet, but maybe it will be by the end of the week.
John?
Yes, John.
I see your list of books. I don't think anybody can understand the Northwest without having read one particular good book of the Northwest. It's I Heard the Owl Call My Name.
Oh, yeah, that's a great book.
Read that, you need to, before you have any further discussion like this, answer that question.
Thank you.
Actually,
that used to be in the Holden bookstore. I don't know if it still is or not.
I Heard the Owl Call My Name.
Yeah, do you remember that author for that one?
No, I don't, but it needs to be there.
It's about an Episcopal priest.
It's a good boy. That's a really good book.
Another good book is The Sons of the Prophets by Dick Spiedel, I think. Spiedel is his last name. And if you want to learn the history of Seattle from 1850 to 1900, you'll find that really intriguing. His prophets is P-R-O-F-I-T-S, and Seattle really made, during the gold rush, made most of his money on prostitution, not the gold rush. It was the people coming through here that...
Right. And that's cultural, isn't it?
Well, on that note, why don't we close with a prayer? Gracious God, we give you thanks for all your gifts, and we thank you for the gift of the place in which you've called us. We ask that you would help us to understand it better, and help us, give us the wisdom to share your word in a way that people can understand and hear it as good news. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.